Hi, welcome to the Movie Vault. I am Zach.
And I'm Ben.
Great. Today we are reviewing the classic movie, 2001 A Space Odyssey.
What? I've never heard of this movie.
Well, that's tough because we just watched it and it was great. So it's 1968. That's when this was released. Yep, it is directed and produced by the Stanley Kubrick, of which we have already done one film of in a review, Dr. Strangelove. And How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Yep.
That's a long title. This one also has a colon in the name, but it's just a 2001 A Space Odyssey. Were we born in 2001 yet?
Were you born? I was not. You were not either.
Okay, that's correct. So even in 1968, what the future would possibly look like, we were born after that. So yep. Stanley Kubrick's envisioning the future, we were born a year after what his envisioning was.
We're in the future.
Anyway. It's based off of a book by Arthur C. Clarke, and it's actually his short story called The Sentinel, and then he published an actual book, and then he actually did a sequel, and they made a movie off that sequel as well.
That's just as critically acclaimed and well-regarded, right?
Yeah, well, we'll get into that. We'll get into how much better that one is than this one. Mm. But, so we've heard about this movie. Neither of us have seen it before this time, right?
No.
Okay. So we've heard about this movie for a long time. What were your... Let me ask this. This is a better specific question. Going into it... I don't think we need to go over the plot. I think the plot's pretty straightforward. I mean, let me just say
this. Oh, it's so straightforward. Nobody could ever get confused about this
It's really
movie.
Just... There is a... There's this monolith that shows up in to the monkeys, the apes, right? They're apes. Yeah. And... or human... Humanims? How do they say that? And... They fast forward evolution and then fast forward from that. So a monolith shows up to these apes or creatures, Neanderthals. They learn how to use tools, blah, 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 evolve. Many, 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 many time passes. And we are now in space. Earth has not only globalized but planetized. And they found another monolith on another planet. So this doctor... Haywood is going to another planet on a secret mission to go see why this monolith is transmitting a radio wave to Jupiter. And then they go, and he gets there, and he you kind of just emits a radio wave that's really loud, and then it fast forwards 18 years, and then there's another guy named Dave, and he has another guy, and what's the other guy's name? Dave and who else? But they're in a ship with a robot named Hal with three other scientists that are in body frozen in chambers, and they're going to Jupiter to see what that signal was that was being sent out 18 years ago, and they've been on this mission ever since. And what they're doing is well, eventually Hal makes a mistake. They're told by mission control that it was Hal made a mistake. Hal denies it. They're worried about his behavior. They go to talk in a extravehicular pod, and
they're not the smartest when they do this.
They're rocket scientists, but they don't know rocket science, and or they don't know not rocket science, and they are talking through a window, but they didn't know that Hal could lip read. So then Hal knows that they're teaming up against him. Hal's primary mission is the mission, and he kills the other guy. I need to find his name. And then Dave tries to kill Dave. Dave ends up being able to get back in the ship after getting out of the ship and Hal not letting him back in. And then gets in by jumping through a vacuum of space, still survives, opens the hatch, disconnects Hal. As Hal's disconnected, he begs him not to. And then a video comes up that was being suppressed by Hal. And it
Daisy,
was...
Daisy.
Yeah.
Daisy.
I did not love... That was kind of creepy. And then it's Dr. Haywood saying that what the mission was. And the mission was to see what that radio wave was. Then Dave continues to fly on like nothing happened. He doesn't even mourn his friend. And he goes and finds a monolith orbiting Jupiter and kind of flies into it. And that monolith has a little bit different powers or whatever. It is like a portal. He goes through all these transcendental weird images and sees all these things. And then he's in this old Victorian house.
Yep.
And he sees an older self, becomes that older self, sees another older self, becomes that older self, sees the oldest self, becomes that. And then a monolith appears at the foot of his bed as he's dying in his bed. And then all of a sudden it cuts to him, a giant fetus, or like right next to, was it Earth?
Yep.
And that was the end.
Yeah.
So what's your first impression of the intro of the movie?
Of the intro of the movie? I think the intro, the movie is titled 2001 A Space Odyssey. So the intro is a little off-putting. If you have no, I think I did know that there were apes of some kind in the movie, so it wasn't completely
hominins. Cut off, so I see
hominins of some kind, but it was rather odd to have the first, you know, 20 to 30 minutes be about the apes, essentially just their life, what happens, and then there's a couple interesting scenes there where they're shrieking. Then we see the tool after they find the monolith. He creates the like hammer or the weapon, or basically a club that he can kill things with. And then we see them, the first murder, where they murder another ape,
which was awesome.
Just seems like they did it because they could.
That was sweet. Like I was wondering, did they eat him?
That's a good question, because then they start eating some of the other animals, and we wondered whether that was the first time they ate meat. We don't know for sure, but it might be implied.
Yeah, because they're discovering new things, like first murder, first tool. I'm assuming first time eating meat, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I think the intro is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's really long. This entire movie's barely anything is said.
No.
It's like just visuals.
And then you finally get, there's the bone thrown up in the air. They transition to space. And then you finally get a character. And that character is... Oh, my tabs got closed.
Dr. Haywood?
Dr. Haywood.
That's the first scientist that's on the secret mission.
And I think you kind of think that he's going to be, like, the main character of the movie. But then after his scene's done, other than that video at the end, you don't see him again. So, really interesting. But they spend a lot of time with him. That's the thing. They take their time doing everything. They show him going up to space, the process of going... His initial launch from the Earth, basically, and then going up to the initial spacecraft, him meeting with some scientists, and eventually getting briefed by the security guard. Then he goes up to Clavius, where there's an epidemic that has broken out. That is not really an epidemic. It's where they found the monolith. And it shows him meeting with the scientists there and explaining why they have to call it an epidemic. And then him landing on Clavius takes like five to 10 minutes. And then... He goes on this other ship over to the actual site, and that takes some time.
Yeah.
And we get to see some details there. There's the use of the toilet is very... there's like 7 long steps you have to follow.
Yeah.
I
would hate to miss a step.
Yep, that would be bad.
So actually, like, the thing about the beginning part that stuck out to me was that you just hear beeping. Beep. 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 Like, for 10 minutes straight, right? And there are so many of these scenes. It reminds me of Avatar. Avatar's obviously influenced by this. But there are so many scenes where it's just like, you feel like you're there because you're just listening to the background noises. It's just like white noise and spaceship rocket sounds and beeps.
Yeah.
The entire time. No talking. And I actually looked into this. So there's a 29-minute film called Universe, which is by a biographer named Vincent Labruto. And that was an inspiration for Kubrick. And actually, NASA uses it to show future astronauts in training what space is actually like. So it's this short film that is like just about beeps, silence, not being able to hear each other in space, only through intercoms. And it's very interesting because I didn't watch it, but I've read a little bit about it. And it's just interesting that that's what Kubrick literally took like a NASA instructional video, used as a NASA instructional video as inspiration for what it would actually be like. So he's going for realistic, which is odd in a space movie in 1968, the year before the moon landing.
Right.
So what is that? How do you think that fits in? Do you think people thought this was realistic, maybe?
I think, yes. I think this is the first time that people probably felt like they got a realistic look at space in a movie. I don't know that 100%, but I'm pretty confident.
And then was it 4 years after, 5 years after this, Star Wars? Was that 73?
I want to say it was 77, but...
Oh, you're probably right. I can't think. But it's
77.
It's so many years after that the original Star Wars came out.
Yeah, almost 10.
And to think,
although they were working on it well before that.
And to think of how well this movie holds up today, even compared to Star Wars, which is the standard.
Yeah.
If that's the standard, then what is this? This is great. So I, it's just confusing. Practical effects, like I think we said that when we were watching it.
Yeah, a lot of models, a lot of filters. Basically, you know, like now it's you can solve any problem using computer-generated effects. But back then, you had to get more, a lot more creative to solve your issues. I'm trying to figure out, like, so you mentioned that there's a lot of noises and silence, but there's also a lot of classical music that's used throughout the movie to set. Like, and I don't... The main theme is Thus Spake Zarathustra, which is a Strauss. I don't even know how to pronounce it. But it's immediately recognizable, even if you've never seen the movie.
That one.
Like, I took a music class, and I had not seen 2001 A Space Odyssey up to this point, and they showed this scene, and I immediately recognized the song. I was like, oh yeah, I've heard that before. Because they probably use it in other stuff, reference it, that sort of thing. Then there's that. Which is also a very famous song. I just am not sure.
I always picture that as like a ballet song.
Yeah.
Like in a Nutcracker. But you're right. I think Kubrick said that he wanted to film a primarily nonverbal experience. That it's not really, you know, relying on the traditional techniques of narrative, you know, cinema. But music plays like a vital role in making the different moods of the film. And like half the music is like classical, and it's half the music appears before any line of dialogue is spoken, basically.
Oh yeah.
It's like you're so far into the movie, and there are only probably 5 conversations in this film.
Yeah.
And you get a whole plot from it. It's right. Crazy. It's awesome.
Yeah, they reveal enough that you get what's going on. And then, so yeah, once they cut from Clavius, it's like 17 months later, they're on a mission to Jupiter, which is kind of a... I was like, wait, what? All of a sudden, we're just going to Jupiter now? And I think maybe, like, I had heard of HAL. I think I was talking to someone today, and I was like, oh yeah, we did 2001 A Space Odyssey. And they hadn't seen it. And he was like, oh, isn't that the movie with the robot that takes over the ship? And I was like, oh yeah, it is. But that's like... only a part of the movie.
Oh, for sure.
It's only like, it might be longer than I'm thinking, but it's like 45 minute part of the movie, maybe. I want to say at most.
Yeah, I'd say less than that.
Where Hal is involved. I think
his terrorizing of Dave and Frank is probably 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But he's in the movie for probably 45 minutes.
Yeah. And they introduce Hal, he's running the ship, and they introduce Dave and Frank.
Yeah.
And those are the two guys who are awake. And there's like 300 scientists who are...
No, three.
Three scientists.
Yeah.
For some reason, I got confused and thought there were 300 at one point. I was like, man, this is a bigger ship than
no,
I thought.
No, there are only three.
Okay. So there's 5 guys on the ship. 2 of them are awake. They're saving the other 3, presumably, for when they get to their destination. But Hal's basically controlling everything.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great because he doesn't have any errors, supposedly. But then they find out that he does have an error.
Yeah, and he denies it, and that causes him to kind of almost... Do you think he schemed that? Did it seem like he purposefully messed up that one first part? This is what happened, seriously. This is what happened. First, he says, Dave, I'm worried that you are not fully committed. Like, you're having second thoughts about this mission. And then the error happens. And, well, then he presents the error, at least. And then after that, they go to fix the error, and that's when they come back in. Before they go to fix the error, they're in that pod, and then Hal realizes that they're going to team up against him because they've realized that Hal's lying. And then it's like, I feel like Hal was trying to avoid at all costs the mission, like its success.
He was
trying to avoid the mission's failure. Sorry, that's what I meant to say.
Yeah, so he viewed the humans as being the people who were going to cause the mission to fail.
Yeah, he's like, you're having second thoughts, right? Can I ask you a very personal question? That's creepy, by the way.
Yeah, because they were trying to figure out whether he had emotion at one point.
Yeah, and they said they don't know. They just treat him like a guy.
There's no way to know.
They're used to him. It's like us with Siri. Like, we're used to her. You know? or ChatGPT.
They would have a conversation. They would play chess with Hal. But Hal didn't have any emotional connection to them. It didn't appear, because he was easily willing to sacrifice them if he felt like they were detrimental to the mission.
Yeah. It was funny when they were playing chess. Hal's like, I enjoyed my time playing chess with you. Like, right after he won. He's like, I resign. It's just funny.
He's like, I did too. Thank you.
But it's just like, yeah. So I would be so scared if I were in the trip with Hal or anything like Hal. Not because of this movie. Hal's voice was too soft and freaky.
Yeah, well, it was like a real human voice. That's the other thing. They didn't try to dress it up at all. It's just like a voice actor.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think those are the main three elements of the film. Now, a few like clarity questions. I feel like we should get through these. So my first thing is, so we're supposed to assume that when they go on Jupiter, they go to, was it Clavius? And Dr. Haywood's there, and they're walking down in their spacesuits to the monolith, and it starts ringing, right? There's loud ringing noise. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Are we supposed to assume that that's the signal being sent to Jupiter that causes the other mission to happen with Dave and Frank? Because it cuts from there. We don't know what happens.
Yeah, I don't know.
It just goes straight from that to Dave. So I'm not really sure.
I have no idea what you're supposed to get out of the ringing.
Yeah, I'm assuming that that's the signal that in the end of the film, when Dr. Haywood's on the, when he's disconnecting Hal, when Dave's disconnecting Hal, and Dr. Haywood says that the mission was for that signal, I'm assuming that that was the signal.
Yeah.
Because they were sent. They were sent probably after that 17 years away from Clavius to Jupiter. Because travel would be forever. You can't just take a road trip to another planet. You kind of got to stick where you're at.
And David pointed out while we were watching it, it's like they're traveling at like so such a fast speed, but it looks like they're barely going anywhere at all.
Yeah, relative speed for sure. Yeah. But anyway, let's see. The next topic, what I would say is after the beginning, is artificial intelligence. What do we think about that? What's your view on artificial intelligence?
It's amazing. We should all want it in our brains, and that's pretty much my view.
Neuralink is FDA approved for human trials.
Oh, interesting. That just happened recently?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. We'll see what happens. I think we've talked about AI so many times, but this is like a an actual dilemma here, because how it's like, if the AI isn't set right to value human life over whatever mission or task it's supposed to accomplish, then it potentially puts human life at risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I don't know how that works. Did the AI decide that the mission was the most important thing?
He was programmed that way. No decisions
were
made. So
it's human error, ultimately.
Exactly. What do you fear about AI the most? It's not the AI itself. It's the programmers.
Yeah. And maybe the power and the temptation that comes along with having access, like all the access to everything all the time. I don't know. But you're right. Or like the power doesn't necessarily come from the user as much as it comes from, like, I'm thinking Neuralink. Like, you could be more influenced by whoever installed that in your brain, okay. I guess.
But what about, like, a
what is the impact on how it makes you think?
What about, like, a Hal or a Wally situation?
I don't know. It just depends. You have to react to the AI almost like it's another person and be, like, assessing its
thought processes.
But then, again, you could be way more vulnerable than the AI compared to, like, another human.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Depending on what the AI controls.
Yeah. True. Yeah, I don't know. I think for me it would be tough to ever trust an AI with anything important.
Yeah. I agree.
And I'm getting more comfortable with AI, I'm not gonna lie. Maybe one day I'll be convinced to be in the FDA trial. I don't know. We'll see.
That's seems like it's hard to push against anything that's like generally going to push technology forward. Like, it seems like that's never happened in human history, that people have denied something that was going to progress technology. Like, it always happens.
It happens even with resistance.
Yeah. So I think that's where I'm like, is resistance just futile? Because there's probably people who are like, the internet's dangerous, and I mean to some degree they weren't necessarily wrong.
Yeah.
But it also has improved a lot of things.
True.
Nothing like that doesn't have like like the internet isn't a conscious being, so it's all related to how humans use it that determines its good or bad or its worth.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an interesting thing. I remember in For a Few Dollars More, the prospector guy was like, those trains!
Yeah.
He, you know, he's worried about that. I'm wondering if AI is just the next train.
Yeah.
Or if it's more serious.
People always... I mean, I guess you question whether it's a bigger jump in technology than, like, a train would have been.
Yeah.
Like, horses... like, transport. It's a mode of transport. So, yeah, it would have been able to transport a lot faster. Would have changed how people were able to do things. But this is, like, literally... could change the way that we think, how we do things, what sure. jobs are like. It could change every aspect of human life, pretty much. But then we've already had things that's happened, and we just kind of seamlessly integrate them into our lives.
Yeah, AI does a lot of our taxes and anything streamlining in that way. And that's fine. You know, it's stuff that we don't need to waste our time doing.
Right. Stuff that's tedious that, yeah, maybe wouldn't be the best... use of our time anyway.
But we don't need AI to raise our children or
no,
or kiss our wives.
No.
Or those are the only two I can think of.
Well, like anything that's like a that blocks humans' connection to one another in the way that they were intended to be, right?
I guess, yeah. I also
think... This is a weird scenario because it's a very isolating scenario and it's a specific scenario that's science related.
I also think that specifically with an AI like HAL, there must have been trust in HAL. There's never an error. But if there's never an error, that causes me to mistrust. You know what I mean?
Anybody that says they could never make an error, any machine?
Yeah. And I'm like, of course the machine is going to say that. You're a patent. You want your product to be, you know, flawless.
Right.
That's a want of the designer.
And the machine's like selling itself too. It's designed to be a salesman for its own product.
I'm wondering if HAL would have had an easier time if he just was a little bit more humble.
Maybe. Like, what could he could have still, maybe he could have won because he would have been more deceptive.
Yeah. But I think he's too factual, just slightly too factual to the point where he told the truth, like, I've never made an error, because he actually believes that, or he's programmed to believe that. But what is a belief?
So is that what caused his error, is that he thought, like, the fact that he was programmed to think he couldn't make an error made him not realize the error that he made?
Yes.
Or did he realize that he made the error and then was trying to cover it up to keep up the integrity of that he couldn't make errors? Which would make him seem more like a human, if that was the case.
Yeah. It seems like there were no errors made, and he was telling the truth. I don't think Hal lied whatsoever.
So there was no error.
He made no error.
Okay.
Everything he did was for the mission.
Then he orchestrated everything in order so that he could get rid of
yes.
the humans, because he was worried about them.
He was worried about the mission.
And their... like the confidence that he had in their like desire to be on the mission and do yeah. stuff.
So I think when he said it was human error, that was him telling the truth and not using any guard against his plan. So I think he was stupid in that moment and kind of slipped up saying, I have never made an error, implying that what he did was either not an error or he did make an error and he's wrong. Either way, there's no trust in that.
Right.
So I think that was Hal slipping up. If Hal said, oh, yes, I apologize, I made an error, you know, that would have been, I would have had more trust. I'm just picturing myself as Dave, not Frank, it's Dave, eating some paste and watching myself on the news. He's probably one of the most famous people in the galaxy. Man, but
can you imagine how boring it must be to be on that ship?
I wonder if they had movies on the ship.
You gotta hope so.
Yeah. Or if they're just doing science all day. I mean, if there's an AI on the ship, the AI can take care of everything.
Yeah, true.
I'm just thinking, like, it would be kind of nice, actually.
Yeah, the AI just assists you with most difficult things, and then you just make, like, major calls.
Yeah, correct.
End of the day.
What if, like, there was a one-month spaceship cruise like that, and it's just, like, a white spaceship like that, and it's, like, a circle exactly like that, and you just go and you watch movies... and you just, it's like a movie marathon. You're isolating yourself from society, and it's like $1 billion to go on it. It'd be kind of nice.
Because I guess space, like, once you see it, for a couple seconds, you're like, oh, there's not like much to see.
Looks better in the pictures.
You're orbiting around the Earth. I guess you could see different sides of the Earth. But if you're just going out into space, I mean, it's just a void. So
no,
might as well watch movies.
I agree. But it would be fun, like, taking a whole month in isolation. It doesn't have to be in a spaceship necessarily. I'm thinking of the idea of just taking a break and watching movies.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's just my thought.
If you wanted to kickstart your movie review career, it might not be a bad idea.
True. So what do we think?
We always have to tie everything to careers as Americans, I noticed. Okay. Or those in the U.S. Yeah,
since you're going to London, you have all this extra knowledge you got to share with us Americans.
Yeah, people in London just do stuff for hobbies and for fun. They don't expect everything to turn into a moneymaker.
Yeah, true. But there's no Hollywood, consequently, in Britain.
No, there is not.
So what do we think about this loose plot structure?
I think it's well utilized in this movie. Here is what I was thinking about. So there is a little movie that we reviewed 30 or so episodes ago, maybe 40, close to 40, called Interstellar. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people would consider that to be the modern like space movie that like is the standard. But that movie is extremely concrete, has a plot, and goes really into string theory and lots of physics related things. So it's in a lot of ways like a foil to this movie, because it does a lot of things related to space and visuals and all of that that we're pushing things forward, but it also doesn't have any of this looser abstract plot structure. It's so incredibly concrete, and that's because Nolan himself is just, that's the way he is as a filmmaker. Everything is like a concrete thing. Don't mix him in abstract. I think Stanley Kubrick is more concerned about, I've watched more movies, I've become more accustomed to this idea of like, not everything has to be spelled out for you. Sometimes it's like nice when the filmmaker just leaves things, like lets you sit in the moments that he presents to you, lets you focus on them, and then you kind of think about what happened. Sometimes I don't even know that the filmmaker had a complete idea of what is exactly happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a loose, I mean, like you said, it's like a loose concept. So I think it works really well for this movie because I don't know how much, whether they could have executed an Interstellar like plot at that point in time. Like, I don't know how much they knew. I mean, obviously Einstein had already come up with his theory of relativity. I think they even referenced it at points in the movie. But I think you can write yourself into a bad situation if you overwrite certain movies, especially about science or things that are more theoretical. So I think it was to the benefit of the movie overall.
Yeah, and you have to think the book that it was based off of, that these monolith things are the driving force of nature. So that by itself is untrue and causes the story to get to some wanky places, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, true.
So the monolith is this thing that serves different purposes throughout human history, specifically. With the homonyms, or whatever they're called, it speeds up evolution. But when Dave rides into one, it is used as almost a portal to unimaginable understanding.
Yeah.
To the point where, and this is canon, by the way, to the point where he becomes bodiless. It's not in this film, it's in the sequel, which is canon, by the way, by the author. So I'm not really sure like what to think about what the monoliths are or what they represent. Are they, they're supposed to be like an alien race that put them there, and they're kind of like, a lot of people like associate them with, they're called the Firstborns, which are like an alien race that put them there, and they're signaling devices or portals, or they're called stargates. In Wikipedia, if you look up the monolith, it says they're machines of black cuboids whose sides extend in the precise ratio of 1:4:9. I mean, that's just interesting. Like, you know the exact thing. It's these monoliths show up in so many different areas. We'll get into the influence of this film later. But for example, in 2001 in Utah, in the middle of the desert, someone planted a monolith there. Like someone had been planning this for years. So you can tell, like, it's just this mysterious thing that nobody really knows about. And when it's referenced in other films, they don't know it is. So I kind of wonder, like, why make this creative choice? Arthur made this choice, the author, not Stanley. But why make this creative choice of having these almost causes or accelerators that are of unknown source? Is that to keep the plot more simple?
Maybe. I kind of wondered, as you're explaining that, how much they were just using... Are they using this as a plot device for the story, or is this something that they're genuinely like, could believe? Because there are people out there who believe in like stuff like aliens accelerating evolution and things like that. It's like an idea that people have, but I don't know how serious they are. Like, I don't know if they're trying to make a point or like prove anything like that. They're just using it to push the story forward, as best as I can tell. I mean, they have to have center, like, it is the centerpiece of the movie, like you said. So
yeah, and they're of unknown cause, they're unknown origin, to me at least, from the specific film that we watched. I'm interested to know why they have different uses.
Yeah, like, why weren't they all... Because they all clearly touched both of them, and they didn't turn into a portal. Exactly. But all of a sudden, the third one, you fly into it, and it is. Yeah. And then you spend 10 minutes, like, just watching contrasted colors. Yeah. And weird Which imagery. Which is awesome. It was pretty cool.
It shows his eye, like, and his head twitching in different shots. That was kind of creepy, though. I was like, I don't like this. This is a good point to go into the sequel. So, 2001, the first... What is it called? It's called The First Contact? Yeah. The First Contact. And, or The Year We Make Contact. And it's also written by the same author, and it's directed by someone else. It's directed by Peter Hyams? I forget. But basically, Dave becomes bodiless because of this transcendental experience he has with this floating monolith around Jupiter. He visits his wife through a TV. Yeah, that happens. And Dr. Haywood has to come back to go to Jupiter to see what happened to the Discovery, which is the ship that Hal was on. So then he goes with a couple other scientists to Hal, and these monoliths in Jupiter, there's a spot on Jupiter, and these monoliths are like clustering and multiplying. And then they like engulf Jupiter because there are so many of them. And then like they just have to send a signal with their last technological action that they can make, and they send a signal back to Earth saying like, don't make contact with the monolith, and that's really it. So that's an interesting plot that's canon to the story. He asked Kubrick if he could make it. Kubrick said, his quote was, I don't care.
And it seems like
the author Kubrick would say. When the author published this book, the next day he called Stanley Kubrick and said, please make sure that nobody makes a movie off of this so that they don't bother me. But that cannot be true, because this author definitely wrote the sequel to get money, to get another film made, so he can get some royalties.
Yeah.
So, and then he worked cooperatively with Peter Haynes, so that's also a sign.
So he didn't really follow through on that.
All that to say, it's not really that important in context to this film, but that gives a little bit more of what the monoliths are. They're kind of like these aliens put them there. That's like kind of canon. So, anyway. So what do you think about the visuals of this film? Probably the highlight peak thing for me.
Yeah, I think they're amazing. I think they're completely ageless. Like, pretty much everything works. Maybe there's a few things you can say that look... I think the main thing that I'm like, oh, that looks a little weird, I'm not sure whether that worked, was when Frank was flying through space in the yellow suit.
Okay.
That was a little odd looking.
Okay.
It was still kind of endearing in a way, though. So it still kind of worked, but it was like
the only thing like they're trying.
Yeah, like it's like now it's like we look back and we're like, oh wow, that's kind of cool and
weird.
They're trying
so hard.
They're trying so but it doesn't exactly work in that it doesn't really look realistic like a lot of the other things do.
Yeah,
there's so many shots are just like beautiful. The color choices are like amazing. This like set choices are amazing. They thought through so many different aspects. I mean, we expect that out of Kubrick. He's very detail-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's other people involved in the project who are also detail-oriented.
It was just him. But the fact that a movie released in 1968 only has like one thing that looks bad, or maybe another word that's better is unrealistic. Some of these visuals held up better than movies today.
Oh yeah, I mean, crazy. People would much rather watch this than they would watch Ghost Rider.
Or, yeah, I'm thinking of like big budget Marvel movies.
Oh yeah,
like that's crazy to me that CGI. Or like Doctor today the third Doctor so Strange, bad.
Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Like, yeah. I think you make an argument. No, you. I think you just say that 2001: A Space Odyssey has way better visual effects.
Yeah, I know. Made like 50 something years before. It's insane. Yeah. So with all that to say that the cinematography was great. It kind of reminded me of Wes Anderson, and a lot of these shots were like straight down the middle. Like the object was exactly in the middle. And yeah. It was pretty symmetrical.
Symmetrical. Mm-hmm. And even the color palette, you could see a little bit of Wes Anderson. Or Wes Anderson could see some of 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Oh, for sure. That's what I meant to say. And like even the monolith, the sun and the moon lining up.
Yeah.
Like it shows that the monolith is some force of nature, like the sun or the moon, that acts upon the universe.
Right, and they showed that in three different parts.
I believe so.
Because they had the initial movie entrance. The initial entrance. Maybe four different. And then they had a little brief period where they lined up the sun and the moon. Maybe the monolith, was it with the monolith with the apes?
Yes. And then there's one at the bed.
At the bed?
Yeah.
With Jupiter?
Oh, is there one? No,
there's
Jupiter?
One with Jupiter, where the spaceship, right. The monolith,
or is that Clavius?
Maybe it's Clavius.
No, there's one with the apes. There's one, and there's one at the intro. One in the with the hominins, and then there's one.
I think there's one with Jupiter.
Yeah, there is, and there's one on Clavius. There's one on Jupiter. Then there's one with the ship, with the one floating in space. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
So that's the Jupiter one, and then there's one at the foot of his bed. When he starts going into the Victorian room.
Yeah.
When he's laying down about to die.
Yeah. So they come back to the same. That's the sort of thing that you could say this movie's really loose and rant. Some people might say random. But it's actually very cohesive because they keep going back to the same like ideas like portrayed with the camera.
Yeah.
And so I assume that there's a reason that those are, each of those points are tied together through that shot.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there's a common theory that that a lot of these extraterrestrial things are from a fourth dimension? What do you think about that?
I don't understand that. David was kind of explaining it with the cross section, and I guess I could kind of get that, but like I barely understood Interstellar, so I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know either.
But Interstellar, if I remember correctly, and spoilers for Interstellar, he is like interacting with. Yeah, there's like this place where he's like somehow in the universe, but he can't like interact with it except for in a way where he's like altering, like he comes through the bookshelf, knocks books off the bookshelf, like stuff like that. So
that's the one
maybe
you chose.
If I think about it that way, I could see how possibly the fourth dimensional beings are interacting with the monolith, but I'd have to read and understand more before I could really come down to a conclusion on that. Also, I think this goes back to what I said about Rick and Morty. And like, I feel like for some people it really matters, all of the consistency and what it all means. I think sometimes I'm just like maybe not everything is a puzzle to be solved.
Oh, okay.
Like, maybe I think some people are supposed to some look people like look at movies like it's a puzzle and you have to solve it. But I don't always think that movies are intended to be like perfectly solved, otherwise somebody would have already come up with exactly what everything meant.
No, I think that's so, right with this film because it's directed by Stanley Kubrick. That's why.
Is that, the puzzle is right with this movie?
No, I think that there isn't.
Yeah, so I think people try to come up with something but they'll never be satisfied because there probably wasn't a something to begin with. I think if you do it with Christopher Nolan movies, you would be correct because he made the movies so that there is an equation that is.
Yeah.
But he also, I think, tries to explain it to a degree. Or even something like Donnie Darko is sort of like a puzzle that's supposed to be.
Correct, unsolved. I think that. Solved. Yeah. I think that, yeah, sorry. And I think that to the credit of the people who want to solve the mystery of 2001: A Space Odyssey. It is based off a book that has like canonical events and more details within that could point to a theory that Stanley Kubrick dove into and just didn't explain.
Yeah.
So that's possible. Another thing is that the sequel, like the book sequel, kind of explains a lot of things.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a money grab. It didn't make as much. Wasn't as popular. Pretty bad. But
it still got 66% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is higher than I was expecting. And Roger Ebert gave 2010, and not his face, obviously, 2010 First Contact or whatever it is, he gave it a 3 out of 4, which is not bad. That's Roger Ebert, one of the most famous film critics of all time. So maybe it's worth checking out at some point.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, I never heard of that.
It's better than Don Darko's sequel. What is that called?
Oh, S. Darko.
Yeah, it's got like 1 out of 10 or something.
Yeah,
like
that one's terrible reviews.
Yeah,
had nothing to do with the first one.
This film, what on the top of your head, what has it influenced ever?
Any movie set in space.
Okay.
After it.
Okay.
Has been an influence. I mean, directly, Star Wars and Alien come to mind as the first one there. I'm like, I clearly, like, see the influence on it. Like, we saw specific shots that we were like, oh, that is like so reminiscent of Star Wars.
Yep.
And same with Alien, like with the void of space and like a lot of the practical effects as far as the shots in space with Alien, I think remind me a lot of 2001: A Space Odyssey. Obviously Alien goes a different direction with the actual alien and stuff, but
yeah.
But as far as the space elements, I think they're really influenced by 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I thought the ship that they had looked like Princess Leia's ship.
Yeah.
In A New Hope.
But do you think like space architecture was influenced by this movie, like Death Star?
Yeah,
like,
I think for the prequels at least. I know the prequels are much later, but I think in A Phantom Menace there's like this space station that looks exactly like the circular round rings shaped space station in this. But yeah, I think the fact that the ship could literally look like anything as long as it's able to float. You know, which anything is able to float. It doesn't need to be aerodynamic or anything like that because it's space. So I think maybe George Lucas dove into that a little bit as well. You know, you have like these wacky shaped ships and vehicles. And then also like the space pods that they had. There are a lot of those in Star Wars, like escape pods. I even think of like the EVAs that were hanging off of the extra vehicular things that were hanging off of the ship. In this film that they were talking in, and Hal was lip reading through the window, that like circular ship with the arms that he grabbed Frank's body with, that reminds me of like an escape pod that C-3PO and R2-D2 get in A New Hope right at the beginning when Darth Vader comes to get the Death Star plans, and Princess Leia puts it in R2-D2, and R2-D2 goes in the escape pod and convinces C-3PO to come with him, kind of, and it looked kind of like that. It's not the same shape, but it's like a detachment of a same ship that has a singular purpose.
Yeah. Now, my question, this is kind of going off to the trail of what you were saying, but why was it so important that he went out and got Frank? Because Frank was, like, easily dead.
I think just, like, the thought of that he could ever be alive.
Okay, yeah.
And, like...
Because he just lets him go a bit.
Why not grab the body of... Ben, I would get your body, by the way.
You're right.
I would, because I would want to bury you.
Yeah.
I would take you, even if your body's rotting.
But how would you bury me in space? Wouldn't you just throw me out in space? That would be the burial.
No,
anyway.
I would.
But at least you could have a ceremony.
I would throw you into the storms of Jupiter and let the Great Red Spot destroy you.
Man, I don't want to be alive to experience that, though.
Well, no.
I mean, I wouldn't be alive for very long.
No, you'd be dead. I would never throw you in there when you're alive. What are you talking about?
The gravity would just. Crush me.
No, I'm saying if you were dead.
Yeah,
I would,
you're right.
Burn your body that way. Or put you in some acid rain on whatever planet.
Okay,
that is.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
He didn't grab his helmet though. Maybe grab
that
your
was
helmet.
That was stupid. He's too cocky. Yeah, he grabbed
it worked out for him.
He also grabbed his body cuz like he's bored. I'm just thinking like what else is he going to do? Like is it so urgent that he needs to go back in? I don't know.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Why does he think Hal is going to open the pod doors, though? That's what I don't know.
Why does he think Hal
maybe
will?
Maybe he just didn't plan it out.
Because
he didn't think that Hal... He thought it was an accident still.
Yeah, he didn't know that Hal was being disobedient.
He didn't know that Hal was against him. You're right.
Or had the potential to be disobedient.
Yeah.
That is the tricky thing with AI. You never know its true potential. And it's probably worse than you could ever imagine.
Yeah, true.
ChatGPT.
Mm-hmm.
Siri.
Cortana. Neuralink. I'm telling you, Neuralink will change everything because if you don't have Neuralink and someone has Neuralink, you don't have a chance against them.
True. Like when I get it and you won't?
Yeah. Then all of a sudden you'll just be like saying all these things at the podcast, and I won't have any room to talk because anything I say can be easily disproven right away.
Your opinion is
false. Algorithmically, I went through all of the different possibilities on what this theme could mean, and I came up with...
Yeah, fair enough. So, I think influence, yeah, it goes directly to space movies for sure. After that, you know, you think of, you know, any film that's like alien related has some sense of mystery or object like a monolith in it. You have like, I don't know. I mean, in Star Wars, go back to Star Wars. There, in The Rise of the Skywalker, there's hyperspace in the original film was influenced by the psychedelic visual in 2001: A Space Odyssey. That's what I'm reading on Wikipedia. Because I remember that scene in The Rise of Skywalker where it's like kind of like a little bit trippy, but it's not. But it's like when you go zoom forward in hyperspace, you know? It's like, it looks like those visuals when he goes and flies through the monolith at the end of the film. So there is like an entire catalog of all the films that it has influenced because there are so many. I mean, this is obviously in the Library of Congress's repertoire of films that they pick every single year. It was one of the first ones. It was an earlier one picked. And then it also influenced itself. So Clark wrote 3 total sequels. So there's 2010 Odyssey 2, 2061 Odyssey 3, and 3001 The Final Odyssey. Written 10 years apart, you know. So
yep.
It's interesting to see if someone will make another film, you know, coming up in 2061. I should be alive for that one. I probably won't make the 3001 because that's like 939 years later. So we'll see. I don't know. Hopefully not. And yeah, Tom Hanks is interested in adapting those other 2 novels. So I thought I'd throw that in there. But yeah, I also think of Marvel, you know.
Yeah,
Marvel has a ton of influence from them. A lot of the comics, in fact, from in the 70s and 80s were influenced by this, from Jack Kirby and Stan Lee writing about a lot of space-based characters.
David Bowie's Space Odyssey, or yep. Space Oddity, rather,
yep,
was influenced by 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, and there are tons of other things, like The Who. A lot of that was influenced by them. Yeah. I don't know. Like, in Apple, a lot of times when they fix bugs in their updates, they say, it was a bug, Dave. So those are just some cool things that you get when you do that. And
when there's only, like, 5 lines, they're bound to be memorable.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because Barbie, which we will be reviewing on the Backstage Cinema podcast in the near future, has a teaser trailer, and the opening to the trailer is the opening sequence of 2001.
Wait, I didn't notice that. Mm-hmm.
It's in one of the trailers, not in all of them.
Oh, gotcha. Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, Woody Allen's been influenced by Mel Brooks. The Simpsons is... Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, was a big Kubrick fan. So when he wrote Futurama, he did a ton of Space Odyssey references. The 1994 famous episode of The Simpsons, Deep Space Homer, very influenced by it. South Park. Yeah, Peter Sellers, Tim Burton.
Andrew Airplane Stanton, 2.
Sesame Street. There have been spoofs, like a Canadian spoof in the year 2000, 2001, A Space Travesty. That's stupid. Men in Black, you said Airplane 2, Mystery Science Theater 3000, 13 Reasons Why. Oh, they see the film in the show. Okay.
Yeah.
Probably not like, too much. I was like, what? That show's garbage.
Stanley Kubrick would be rolling over in his grave, or is rolling over in his grave.
Yeah. So, tons and tons and tons of things.
Yeah.
Like NASA's training program has so many references to 2001 A Space Odyssey. And in the museums and everything like that, they send up things like in their ships, like little trinkets of the Space Odyssey movie. That's crazy to me. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk needs to do more of that. That's why that's why all his rockets are blown up, because he doesn't have Stanley Kubrick's touch. So that, with all that to say, it's like, we said Sergio Leone had the greatest influence in the West for Western films, spaghetti Westerns. But for space films, this is probably the birth of space era.
This might be the birth of the space film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure there was movies set in space before this, but this really just took everything to another level.
Like the type of space film that we see, at least.
Yeah, they're not like B-tier sci-fi movies anymore. This is like a main artur cinema. I mean, I don't know. They're just starting to think about movies that way anyway, with the French New Wave being earlier. But think about that also, too, is that like early in the 60s, you got the French New Wave. You're still making Westerns. And all of a sudden, you got sci-fi like just beginning at the end of the decade.
Yeah.
And how much that changed just the potential of what you could do. And now even to this day, a lot of really exciting new movies are sci-fi movies, like the new Blade Runner. I mean, or even the older Blade Runner that Ridley Scott did, which I don't know whether Blade Runner has as much influence from 2001 A Space Odyssey, because they don't spend too much time. They don't really spend any time going out to space, but still the idea of sci-fi being like a thing that you could do as a major director was probably affected by 2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the ending?
Oh, the ending was so strange.
Yeah, I mean, I know you
said the actual ending with the fetus?
Yeah.
I don't is that supposed to, what's that supposed to represent? Like
that's why I think life. It's a fourth dimensional thing. The fourth dimension is what is it? Theorized.
I was trying to think whether it was supposed to be reincarnation. Like, all of a sudden, he's, like, dying, and then he's back to being a fetus, and he's going to go back to Earth.
But why is he the size of Earth, then?
Maybe too literal of a definition.
I'm thinking that
too literal of an interpretation.
He's outside of time. So when he gains full understanding, it doesn't matter what his form is.
Maybe. But then why does he pick a fetus?
Because the fetus is the most comfortable position. That's why at night, when we sleep like that, it feels great.
That's an interesting take. That may just be it.
and to be honest, like you said, I don't know. Is the puzzle supposed to be put together? Probably not.
Yeah. Probably. Like, maybe not. It's supposed to symbolize something, but maybe it's not. I have a hard time saying it's not symbolizing anything, but it might not be as concrete of a thought as some people try to make it.
Yeah. And then what about like the aging? I mean, outside of time.
Yeah, outside of time, being able to see yourself and then as your older self, and that, well, I guess it's weird that he like then he immediately becomes that version and then sees the next version. Yeah, maybe that's just the outside of time thing. Like, time doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah,
he's just taking different forms. Yeah, it is.
It's awesome visual.
I wasn't sure what was gonna happen when, for some reason, it was stuck in my head that somehow the apes were gonna come into the, like into the room.
Like, he would become an ape at the end?
Yeah, like, I kept de-evolve. Thinking that, like, the apes universe and the other universes were going to come together at some point. That never happened, so.
Interesting.
That was a wrong prediction.
No, the apes were just to intro the monolith.
Yeah.
And to have some fun ape action. Just like, constantly.
He just had some fun with it.
Yeah.
Out in the desert. Yeah. We did have a question of whether that was their natural environment.
Yeah, desert apes.
Yeah. I just don't think of apes living in the desert.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're probably saying it wrong. I don't even know if they're apes. Are they depicted?
Yeah.
Hominim?
Hominis.
Hominims. Yeah. But they weren't Homo sapiens yet.
No.
In this film. We skip over lots of time to get there.
It's like, well, it reminds me of... Maybe it also potentially influenced the Pink Floyd song Time.
Oh, okay. Probably.
I was trying to think what line it reminded me of. No, but see, time doesn't necessarily fit in with this movie, because it's talking about how as you get older, time goes faster and then you're closer to dying.
It's an abstract view of time.
But this movie is like, now I'm outside of time, so you wouldn't look
whatever
at it the
happens,
same way.
Happens.
Yeah.
Doesn't time also influence insurance?
It does. Because you only have so much time to get a good insurance claim. Like, for example, if you wait until your car's in a wreck,
to get a car insurance plan, you've already wasted too much time. And so in order to stop that from happening, you're going to want to contact Hedman Anglin Agency. They're known for saving people money on auto, home, and business insurance. So call them at 614-486-7300. That's 614-486-7300. And if you do contact them, make sure to tell them that Ben and Zach sent you. They've been very supportive of the show over the years, and we would like to be supportive of them. So if you don't have car, actually, if you do have car insurance, it doesn't really matter because they could get you a better deal.
Mm.
Or potentially get you a better
deal. Do you care about money?
I care about money.
I'm asking the audience.
I mean, money, that's another Pink Floyd song. So I care about it.
So time?
Time, money, and money.
Love?
Two of the biggest.
Is love one of them?
I don't know that love is one of them. They only value time and money.
Okay.
Brain damage is one of them.
Okay. Time, money, and brain damage. Interesting.
No love. These are all just from Dark Side of the Moon, though.
Yeah.
Which would be the most influential? 2001, The Space Odyssey. I mean, that would influence an album called Dark Side of the Moon.
Clearly. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's all the notes that I had. I don't know. This film was 5 stars
for me. Yeah. I think I hesitated a little bit, but now that I've thought about it, and even when I was thinking about it yesterday, I was like, yeah, this was just an amazing movie.
It's the foundation of what we know, Ben. It has to be 5 stars.
And how many movies are there that I would rather watch that have almost no dialogue, very loose plot structure, other than that one Jim Jarmusch movie we watched?
Oh, Stranger Than Paradise?
Yeah. Very loose plot structure, more dialogue, but still more abstract. But
yeah, but that's way different.
Yeah, way different.
Almost no music. Probably no music. I don't remember.
The only music played would probably be on the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, just goes to show you the wide swath of different types of movies that you can have.
True.
But this is very important. I liked reading the bad reviews because they were all just like, it's boring. I'm just like, I think people just don't have a good enough attention span.
Yeah.
Just live in the... I mean, I did fall asleep for 10 minutes during the movie, but that was because I was really, really tired.
And it was like 2 a.m.?
And it was really late. Not because I thought the movie was boring.
Whoops. Yeah, I agree. I think the people that thought it was boring are just addicted to TikTok.
Yeah.
So, as a non-TikTokian... Oh, ow, I just fell off my couch. As a non-TikTokian, I think that I can be able to appreciate this. And this film came out way before
TikTok. This will help increase your attention span.
What year did this film come out? 68?
Yeah.
What year did TikTok come out?
20.
Oh yeah, it's much before TikTok then. Just had to make sure.
Yeah, a little bit before TikTok.
Okay, good. Sweet.
All right, are we ready to close the vault?
I am ready. How do you do it? I don't know how to do it. I've never done it.
Dun 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 dun.
Dun dun dun.